a very warm welcome to our 101st episode. And I want to start with a special shout out to our longtime number one listener, Mr. Max Miles, who is hoping for a good 101st show. And I think we'll meet him in the middle with a fine one. Got a lot of cool stuff to go over today. Dan has an interesting topic we're going to dive into. Racing yesterday, Olympic stuff to talk about.
Sorry we missed you last week. We were in on a vacation in the Tetons.
Le Grand Tetons.
And just couldn't do it. And I think moving forward, we're probably going to start recording on Monday.
We could keep release. Well, if we're going to record on Monday, I'd probably.
Yeah, record on Monday, release on Monday, I think.
Yeah. I'm a big wig, hot shot English teacher now, so we have to ask you guys to accommodate my very important schedule as I'm doing very important things. But good week to be a cycling fan again. Our last episode, we talked a lot about the cool mountain bike races, touched on the time trial. As the Olympics are drawing close to a close, we had some pretty cool results in the men's and women's road races. I think we should probably start with our very own American, Kristen Faulkner, the rider who was born in a small fishing village in Alaska, went to Harvard, graduated from Harvard in 2016, and then picked up cycling in 2017 as like a fun thing to do on the side. Now, I should point out, 2017 was the year Maybird was founded. So if you go back to the year Maybird was founded, the woman who won gold in the Olympic road race said she was struggling to learn how to clip into and out of her bike shoes. So
interesting.
For those of you who are maybe lacking some motivation, I think that's pretty darn cool. Granted, she does seem to be one of those. Kristen Faulkner does seem to be one of those just kind of grotesquely talented people who are kind of good at everything they touch. But a race where I have to say, like, the big powerhouse teams dropped the ball. Kristen Faulkner executed a pretty textbook, just perfect strategy, you know, basically was chasing immediately upon catching the leader, went off and attacked on her own. The others kind of called her bluff, let her go. We're more worried about each other. And she rode clear, no one else in shot, which was repeated by the men's winner, Mr. Remco Evenepoel, who won, as you'll recall, the time trial a few weeks ago.
Does Olympic road racing, I mean, it doesn't really involve like teams, right? There's only...
Oh, it does involve teams, but it's countries. So it's almost like the worlds, right?
Okay.
So you've got Mathieu van der Poel and Dylan van Baarle working together, right? Irrespective
of
their
trade
teams.
Was she working with anybody?
Kind of. No, I should say, I don't want to minimize how amazing our American team is, but it's not one of it's not the A squad, right? Like, it's not the Netherlands, which has historically been the strongest women's cycling nation. It's not Belgium, because you had Marianne Vos, you had Lotte Kopecky. I'm too lazy to cut out that cough, so you guys just have to live with it. So her teammates did play a role, but this was a solo victory. So, but yeah, teams absolutely play in the Olympics. It's still road racing.
Okay, I'm done coughing.
Okay, if you promise, because, you know, at a certain point, I'll have to cut it, but that's like work I don't feel like doing, so... but really incredible.
Do you think they'll make a movie about her?
I don't know. I kind of hope so. It'd be better than most of the movies that have come out lately.
Yeah.
But yeah, that was amazing. He's an American. It was awesome. Made a splash outside of American media. Someone at the newly outside media acquired Velo News wrote a pretty brain dead article about how she's good at cycling because she was a venture capitalist, and the meme accounts are still having fun with that. So, that was really silly. But yeah, like, it was a really cool race, really cool to see. It was cool to see that as an American, but then as a cycling fan, it was cool to see Remco. And I'll out myself as not like a Remco hater, but as like a Remco skeptic. I said a couple years ago, you know, like, the people who are putting Remco on the same level are basically saying he's like a tour contender or delusional, right? Mm-hmm. And I think I have been somewhat vindicated in that he really didn't threaten Pogacar or Jonas at the tour this year, but he was the best of the rest comfortably, right? And has won a grand tour now, and then winning the time trial like he did against the rider, you know, like, someone, because Remco's like, he's not a big guy, he rides a size small, right? For a rider like that to beat Ganna and Van Aert in the time trial, and then to just sweep the road race, you know, like coming in solo like that. Like he, I think, has established himself as a generational great. And there was this big, you know, kind of homecoming celebration back in Belgium in a soccer stadium where Eddie Merckx handed him a bunch of stuff. And I think it was very much like a symbolic, like, you are the next hope of Belgian cycling to go be the next Merckx. Granted, I still think the next Merckx is Tadej Pogacar, but Slovenia doesn't have some, you know, crotchety old guy like Merckx to kind of hand the crown over. So he'll have to make his own. But it was good. It was like the cycling at the Olympics this year were great. The track stuff was cool too. No disrespect to those guys. I just don't know much about that. So I'll get really bored. And
the pistol shooting was good, right?
The pistol shooting was good. We had that guy who just looked like, you know, a dad in Target who showed up and got like silver.
Yeah.
That Turkish guy, which was really cool. You had the South Korean lady who looked like she was out of the Matrix. That was pretty cool.
I think I'm going to get into speed walking because it looks like something I could do.
Oh, can I be a hater for a sec? The speed walking, if you watch it in slow motion, they're not speed walking. They're running. Because like speed walking, I think the idea is like both of your feet have to, or like your feet have to be touching the ground at the same time or whatever. And like, they're not. You know, like, yeah. I think there's the Olympics is funny because there are some sports that I'll hate on.
Like handball?
I don't know. Even that seems more athletically impressive to me. Because with, and it's, well, I'll backtrack. Because it's like, it is athletically impressive what the speedwalkers do, and I definitely can't do it. But I'm like, you're
we should speedwalk a marathon this winter.
I think that's the only way I could do a marathon is by kind of doing an awkward and, I don't know what the opposite of graceful is, a graceless shuffle. But yeah, the Olympics were good. I like the Olympics. I don't know how I feel about my city getting the Olympics again, but I think in my heart I am excited because I love the Olympics. The Olympics are awesome. Like, I think if nationalism is going to be a thing, I kind of think that's the way to do it. You know, like I was really invested in the U.S. beating China in the medal table. Like I cared about that, right? Like I was excited. And the thing is, like, I'd turn on the Olympics, like getting ready for work or whatever. And just suddenly in the 5 minutes I was watching, get engrossed in like some random running or diving
sport
event or whatever.
You didn't even
and
know
be
existed.
Like when that runner won, Cole, what's his name, won that race, kind of came out of nowhere and beat that Norwegian guy who was the Michael Jordan of long distance, medium distance running, I guess. Like, I was like, oh my gosh, that's so, like, someone I had never heard of, you know, 6.5 minutes earlier, right? So I love the Olympics. I think the Olympics are great. And I think this reminded me why sports are great too and why athletics are great, right? Like, so many cool stories coming out of it, like good sportsmanship moments. All that. So it was really, really cool. Did you watch? Were you watching the Olympics?
Not at all.
Weren't tuning in?
No.
Too exciting for you. That's okay. But yeah, that was great. Closer to home, we had the ICUP yesterday.
Yeah, we've got a lot of cool stuff to go over.
Yeah, we've got a lot of cool stuff.
I'm probably going to forget stuff because we kind of skipped a week. So
yeah.
But I did I did notice that Emma Daly, she did that race like Pierre's Hole or something up in like northern Idaho. And I think I remember seeing her on a podium, and that's just super cool.
As always, I love it when you guys go and do these indie races. Yeah, that's super cool.
That's a race I've heard about that I'd like to try. We had the Derricks, Rocky and Drew, and Jake Levin went out and did Leadville. I mean, we might have had other athletes do Leadville too that I might be forgetting, but.
Oh, I should say Leadville really quick, because that's most of my other cycling world news point I have to hit. Melissa Rollins, local rider, taking the women's win, which was super cool. Keegan putting in a ridiculous time with a flat tire on a really interesting bike that I think we'd maybe dive into on our aerodynamics episode. But Leadville was super cool.
Yes, that's a super cool race. I really want to do it someday. Rocky and Drew and Jake just all did so solid. I know Drew's sporting the big, huge belt buckle. I think he did it like 8.5 hours or something like that. Got sub 9. Super cool that they're out doing that. So yesterday we were up at the ICUP, and my goodness, it was just such a cool day. We had just a really, really cool. It was actually my birthday, and I just thought it was so much fun to be up there with all those cool people on my birthday. I had so much fun. And I was kind of worried not a lot of people were going to be showing up, you know, like not a whole lot of people were showing up on Team Snap, you know, so I didn't buy quite as much food as we normally bring. I only brought two tents instead of three. And, you know, it was kind of a scaled back version a little bit. But what a day. It was just awesome. We had...
We needed three tents. Like, we had tons of people showed up. Lots of family showed up to support, which is always cool.
Yeah, it was a beautiful day. Weather was great. Maybird riders on pretty much every podium.
I let us down in my category, but
yeah,
and everybody else was carrying their weight.
Yeah. But just, lots of people showed great turnout. Lots of podiums. There's...
out of the gates, I have to say really quick, one of the riders that was there was Curtis. Curtis had a great showing. And I have to issue a correction that I promised I'd issue in reference to the pronunciation.
Oh, are we going
to
finally
figure this
out?
Curtis's last name, Kudrow.
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 We were both wrong.
We were both wrong. I was more wrong, but he did tell me that my pronunciation is common. So that makes me feel a little bit better. Like I'm
Kudrow.
In Kudrow.
Because I was just saying Cordo, which
Cordo.
Is...
Cordo. It was like Chondria. He said a lot of people... I think that is maybe a name that people kind of jump to. Because I think it's one of those things where you get lazy and you just see a bunch of words together and you kind of throw something
close. You kind of make
close.
It sound a little Frenchy at the end or something.
But yeah.
Okay, well.
Kudrow, which by the way, again, super classy racer, put in a great effort yesterday. There are a few cool things I want to run over.
Yeah.
I think we have to start with Andrew Preston.
Okay, Andrew Preston was just.
Hilarious.
He showed up like a boss. It was.
Yeah. It was a dominant showing.
Okay, so first of all. Maybe we'll back up a little bit. We forgot to mention the Jibe short track race the night before.
Oh, yes.
Which I think is just a super cool thing Jibe's
cool
doing.
Cool event. Go do it.
Yeah, let's support that moving forward. I couldn't make it, but kids had tons of fun at that. Andrew won like the pro division in short track night before. And then the morning of the iCup, he rode up the canyon with a bunch of friends. And his friends were on gravel bikes. He was on a mountain bike. His friends were pushing a pretty hard pace. He was pushing even harder pace on a mountain bike. And he wasn't going to race. He gets up there after already riding up the canyon. Which
having
is,
not prepped to do a race.
Yeah.
Like out for a ride.
Out for a ride. Hadn't eaten much. What, you know. And he comes up to me. He's like, Dan, should I race? And he grins. And I'm like, yeah, that'd be cool. And he goes and tells his dad. He's like, hey, Brady, Dan told me I should race. So they sign him up for the race. They sign him up for the race, and he just starts off flying, and I'm like, oh man, he's gonna blow up.
Yeah.
But he didn't. He was just like, what was he like minutes ahead of second
comfortably.
Place?
Comfortably. And like wearing like a Maybird jersey from like 3 years ago. Like this is not someone who showed up to race, you know, like the night before, I was like, oh, I'm going to make sure to eat my rice and noodles and whatever and get to bed on time and whatever. And like, you know, I think he, not to minimize the incredibly hard work that he does, but he also just kind of falls into that freakishly talented category of somebody who just has the ability at his fingertips to show up to a race. And like a varsity iCup is no joke.
Like, no, when they rode past the tent... Like the dust cloud was enormous.
Yeah, and it was a huge group. Like it was as big as a varsity race, and you had the basically the top talent there. You know, like if you were looking for who's going to win varsity races, that's a good place to look because a lot of those kids are there.
So Andrew Preston, I think, trains differently than a lot of kids do.
Because he doesn't have a power meter, does he?
Yeah, he doesn't use a power meter. I think he uses this really complex method called having fun.
Yeah,
which you might have heard of, you know, but he like we've got so many kids on the Skyline team that like won't show up to do Skyline intervals or won't show up to the rides because they've got this like top secret training plan they're working on or whatever. Andrew and Ben, like they show up to all the Skyline rides. They show up to like the social rides. They go out and have fun. They're, you know, but the results are pretty awesome, you know, and I know Brady knows what he's doing. And Andrew has some good guidance there, but I truly think Andrew is a good example of how training and getting faster can be fun and it can be social.
And it doesn't have to be clinical. Like we're speaking about the Olympics. I think to win Olympic gold, you probably do have to be pretty clinical. but especially when we're dealing with youth athletes, like, and I don't want to like, I don't want to, I don't want to forget that these kids do have talent that I don't have, right? And that maybe for me, I've thought for a long time that like me being more clinical would help me, right? I think there's a right amount of, but the thing is, if you look at these guys, they're putting in the work. They don't seem to need the structure to do it. And some kids,
well, and I think he has good guidance and good structure, but he does it in a way that he can still go to social rides and still have fun. And you know, it's not.
And you know, he probably has
not too sterile.
He probably has good pacing discipline and just kind of makes good common sense decisions. But I think to your point, like the idea that like you need to like not go to Nike rides to fulfill your training is silly, I think, personally, for me. And you know, I don't know what your journey is with training, if you might have your valid reasons for doing it, but there's probably a Nike ride that you could go to and help out with on your rest day. And there are very few kids who I think are just too good for a Nike ride. And even if you are, being there's good, because like your talent and your example are huge for other kids, you know. And it's easy to say being on the other side of it and being able to look back on a high school experience, like if you're in your high school experience now, that's all you've ever known. You have to remember, you're a baby. Like you have the rest of your life to go. Like I wouldn't sacrifice this kind of well-rounded athletic experience and having fun and being a good example for other kids at the altar of, I have to be as good as I possibly can be right now today, you know. And I think that's what he's a good example of, you know. And it works. And again, he is freakishly talented. I don't want to suggest that like, oh well, you know, start going to your Nike rides or whatever, and you'll suddenly be Andrew Preston. But I do think there's something to be learned there.
Yeah, he rides a lot and he has fun and he's always out there smiling. Every time I see him riding, he's smiling. So
yeah,
I think he's doing something right there. But yeah, huge shout out to him. He had a good day. It was fun. But we had so many other good results. Like the varsity girls was unbelievably stacked. Like all the top racers in the state showed up for that race. And McCall Birkinshaw was able to hang with the best of the best and come in a close second. She's a super consistent rider, works super hard, does just about everything right, and it's paying off, you know. So
also very talented.
Yeah, very talented. Yeah, shout out to her. We had Isaiah Ward. He's from Utah County. He came out and raced and got like second in JV. And we had Gordon Rice is a kid I just love to ride with. He's just such a classy. He's really quiet, super quiet. Not obnoxious at all, you know, but he just kind of comes and rides. But he had a killer race. But like our freshman boys had a few podiums there. Our freshman girls had a few podiums there. Just such an awesome, rewarding, fun day.
Spencer Wood was doing the expert men category, which I want to see more Maybird riders in. He killed it. Like my goal for yesterday was to finish with him. Super cool to see him. I also have to like throw out that I just saw a lot of Maybird riders being super classy. And I had an experience yesterday where like I saw someone not being classy, and it kind of reminded me why I like this team and our culture. You know, like I'd on the second lap, one of the guys in my category who was maybe 2-3 guys ahead of me crashed really, really hard at the top of Baby Thunder. And I kind of came around a corner and he was down. So I stopped and I called you to get a medic to come up. And we had another guy who was kind of telling people to slow down because this guy was like sprawled out across the trail, mm-hmm. right? Like you could get by him, but you basically had to get off your bike to do it. And this guy came through, and I have to say, this guy was really fast and he was on his way to a big result. But he came in quickly, which is okay because it's a race course, right? But then was really annoyed with the guy who slowed him down, and then decided to use some profanity to express that he wasn't happy with being slowed down around an injured rider at an I-Cup. Now, if it had been the Olympic Games, I would be annoyed. But the fact that you're like having that reaction at an I-Cup sucks. And obviously I'm not going to tell. I didn't really even know this guy, but like I was like, that sucks. Like save that for the soccer field or whatever else, like the Costco parking lot. Like that's not cool. And so like it was a good reminder of like like, I love that mountain biking is a cool sport where people are courteous, and I want to keep it that way.
Actually,
so, like,
let's be nice at the Costco parking lot.
Yeah, but you get what I'm saying, I know. Right? I was like, that's, and you know, here's the thing. I know that it's like a tense moment when you're in a bike race, but, and you'll back me up on this, the best bike riders are so cool. Like the guy who won yesterday, Justin Desolates, who I've known forever, right? He was going by, I let him pass. I was going to pace him, but I figured I'd take it easy on him and just let him go. He was so cool when he passed on his way to like winning the elite race, you know, like it, yeah. So like, it was a good reminder that like, I love the culture of this team, that like, I know anybody on this team would not have had that reaction. And in this, what, 7-8 years we've been doing this, like it's always been that way. So thank you guys for that. One more shout out to Cole Horner. Did you feel Cole's front wheel? Like with that, he basically tacoed his rotor. Did you spin that front wheel? You could barely spin his wheel
and he couldn't shift his gears either.
So that, the rotor issue alone, like let's leave the fact that he couldn't shift out. That'll be like a B or C tier issue. That rotor was robbing between 60 and 100 watts from Cole. No sweat. And I know I'm prone to exaggeration on occasion. I'm not exaggerating here. If that had happened to me, I would have pulled out. I'd be like, oh, this is pointless. This is like, that to me would be a mechanical on the same level as both of my wheels dissolving underneath me. I'd be like, this is pointless. Like this, I can't, you know, granted for me having 100 watts, Rob leaves me with like 0 watts, but Cole still went on to like get like not only to finish, but to get like a good result, which was just another one of those like crazy cool.
Yeah, he's an incredible athlete.
So I have to shout out Cole for that too.
You know, the thing, I want to say something. So Snowbird is a course that like, when you talk about cyclists as a whole.
Yes, I was going like, to say this.
As you talk about this, cyclists yeah. as a whole. A small, like maybe 1% of cyclists as a whole ever race on a course that's anything like Snowbird.
Yeah.
It's not typical of cycling as a whole because it's so steep. It's so steep up and it's so steep down.
Well, and it's rough. Like Snowbird's just rough.
Yeah.
You know, and it really rewards the complete riders.
Yeah. And so I didn't sign up for the race.
Wiener.
Because I didn't want to lose a race on my birthday. It was kind of
I get it. I feel
you know, it's hard. But I felt a little because I mean, I have my strengths, I have my weaknesses. Snowbird doesn't accentuate my strengths. You know, I can do fairly well in like a Richfield course or a gradual long flat.
Like the Southern
climb.
Utah ones at like the first I Cups, I always do better at than Snowbird.
Yeah, there's courses I can do fairly well on. There's trails I do fairly well on. I really, to be honest, kind of struggle at Snowbird. Because
some studies suggest that this might be connected to our burrito consumption. The science is out on that. But climbing courses are rough.
Yeah, it's rough. But I did want to shout out one other person, and that's Seth Sherrington. I see him out on that pink bike riding all the time. He is putting in the work, and it's really an inspiration to me. You know, and I just... I just think it's so cool what he's been doing. And I can tell just that he's getting fitter and stronger. And I could tell he was a little disappointed at his result at that race. But I just want him to know, man, just keep it up. Because that course is brutal for some people. And there's courses you're going to just crush it at.
Yeah.
You know, and, you know, you're going to have one or two bad races here and there. But we got, like, sometimes when we're in the high school racing mindset, like that next race is the end of the world, basically, you know, but it's really not, because really, as we've said so many times, the whole goal with Maybird is that one day you guys are just rad, awesome 50-year-olds riding with other kids, you know, that are able to win age division races at wherever you end up living or whatever, you know, it's not about this most recent race or the race coming up. It's about a long game. And if you have a bad result that you're bummed about, that's totally understandable. You know, that happens.
Like, I'm not particularly happy with my performance yesterday. You know? Like I felt garbage and I don't know where
I finished.
Very
few performances I've been happy about, but
yeah,
I love doing it and it's so much fun and I'm a better, healthier, happier person because I do it. So, hang in there. Yeah.
And in the short term, and I don't want to, not to belabor the point here. I know this intro has been super long and I've talked about this before too, but like cycling is, of all the sports, is probably the one that looks the most different day to day to day. And like, Missoula is a different course from Vernal, and Vernal's a different course from St. George, and Snowbird's a different course. You know, like very few riders are truly complete riders who can be Superman everywhere. Like, you know, and I think, and for me, like, I've found a lot of motivation in finding stuff that I'm good at and trying a bunch of different stuff. You know, like, some of you might get into cross country, or particular kind of cross country racing through Nika, and that's your jam. For me, like, I found cross. I'm still not that great, but I'm like, I feel like I'm better at cross than cross country without trying as much with cross, right? Like, I have better results at the early season Southern Utah I-Cups than Snowbird, you know, like, you know.
Well, I just love the long all day adventure rides, you know. And
right, and you know what,
you know, cross country racing stresses me out, but
like
those...
you don't do much short track in cyclocross, and some, you know, some kids walk into this team probably capable of doing point to point. Some people ride bikes for 15 years and would struggle to do point to point, but you don't want to sprint against them, right? So like, remember that, like, cycling isn't a sport and mountain biking is barely a sport. Like, you can get so specialized. So I do think train your weaknesses, but sometimes maybe race your strengths, you know. And if you're not racing your strengths, give yourself grace, you know. And also give yourself the kind of growth mindset to say, like, you know, for me it was descending forever. Like, you remember descending was like the, you want to, like, the, you know, they say like the monkey on your back or whatever forever, right? And now I think in most races descending is a strength of mine because I've worked on it. So, you know. And you guys are also young too. Like, I don't remember any results. You know, the funny thing is, I remember like zero bad results I got. I only kind of remember the good results from being younger anyway. So, like, what's Kate Courtney's thing? Like, be disappointed for 48 hours?
Yeah. Or, yeah. You can be disappointed for 24 hours and then, or you can celebrate or be disappointed.
Right.
For,
yeah. That's what it was. Yeah.
So just for 24 hours. Then you got to move on and get ready for the next thing.
And also, at final pitch, try different flavors of cycling, man. You know, like, I mean, like, I think cross country should be your main thing because you live where you do, but like, try different types of races. Do some short track with Jibe on Friday nights, do point to point, do True Grit, do Nika, do it all. Find stuff that motivates you. And you know what? Find motivation in the stuff that, you know, isn't your jam yet. So, but like, super gritty race from everyone yesterday too. Like, I was telling, when like Tessa asked me how the race went, I was like, it just hurt. That one's just painful, man. And yesterday was like the kind of blow up and then do a painful time trial event for me, which is way less fun than getting tactical in a group and everything. Yeah,
and
so.
I feel bad I didn't race, but instead I rode up Big Cottonwood with Andrew.
Yeah.
And then we descended in the rain.
That's always fun.
And that was the most terrifying thing I've ever done. And I was just worried my son was going to die with the speed he was going.
Yeah, I worry about him too. I descended that with him. I mean, he's good, but... maybe don't try road cycling. I think if we had lawyers, they'd tell us not to tell you to do road cycling, but you know,
think we should probably get going in our,
it's funny. Some weeks, especially in the winter, we just kind of struggle to think of news and we basically don't do a news segment. And then other points we could probably just do a cycling goings on podcast. But you have put some thought into this, and especially where we've had a few extra days off, block periodization.
Yes. I put quite a bit of work into this one. And yeah, it's been interesting in there. So block periodization is something, it's kind of a term that gets tossed around that I don't think always means what people, or it has a bunch of different meanings.
Like, can I take a crack at what I kind of would, if someone said block periodization, I'd be like, okay, periodization is like you do base in the winter and then more intervals closer to your race. And then when people talk about training blocks, I'm like, oh, well, you've got nationals you want to do well at, so you do kind of a block before that. And then you've got Nika later and or cross or whatever later on down the line or point to point, so you do a block for that. Am I in the
you're
ballpark?
Actually pretty close to the true definition. That's pretty impressive.
So I didn't serve your point here.
No, you were supposed to botch it. Oh, okay. But you didn't.
Is block periodization like
no well yeah, so I bought I've talked about Vladimir Erzurum before, and he's kind of the father of block periodization, and
everyone knows this,
you know, and
not the Vladimir Erzurum you went to high school with.
you know, traditional periodization came out in like the 50s. Block periodization came out in like the late 80s. And he's kind of the one that, and it really kind of like shot the Soviets up into dominance in sport because of,
as did other things, but I guess we can't talk either.
It was just the block periodization. Yeah. Nothing else.
Nothing else.
And he didn't really, and afterwards he came out later and kind of, revealed a lot of his theories and his concepts in a book.
Hmm.
And I've heard this book referenced a lot. I actually bought the book. It cost me about $100.
What?
And it is a terribly...
Did you go into Amazon.ru? Like, where did you find it?
No, I found it. It was on Amazon. Huh. And it basically reads like a textbook. And it was a fairly difficult read. I actually think he should have got someone like, you know, maybe someone else to write it that's maybe a little more entertaining, but it basically read like a textbook.
Lots of yucks in there. real page turner.
Yeah. So, but lots of good stuff in there and, lots of good principles that I think we can apply. But with block periodization, I do think that a lot of people kind of use that term and it doesn't really very well align with what Vladimir Izeron developed.
So really quick, what is the definition you're thinking of that some people might have in their heads that you want them to...
If you go to YouTube and do research on block periodization, what you're probably going to find...
is not a lot of helpful stuff?
No, actually helpful stuff, but you're gonna find... Like a lot of people kind of think it's when you do like a week that's just like a hell week. You know, like we do like a week of training that's just tons of intensity, tons of volume, just really above and beyond what your normal week is. And then following that, you take an extended amount of recovery after that to hopefully get a fitness bump from that. And a lot of people call that block training, you know.
Kind of on a micro level?
And, you know, and I think that, and there's different terms for that, like... I usually call that an exhaust week. Like usually when I do like traditional periodization, you know, the week before a recovery week, I'll usually make that a bigger week.
We talk about like the week before your family's Mexico vacation, you empty the tank. And then
yeah,
rest,
exactly.
Right?
Okay. I do that all the time. If someone's going on vacation, rather than bringing their bike on vacation, I'm like, well, let's just destroy you.
Yeah, just empty the tank and then sleep on the plane and sit on the beach, right?
Yeah, exactly. And you know, so I think a lot of people, when they think of block periodization, that's kind of what they think of. A lot of kind of what you'll see on YouTube is what they call kitchen sink training, where you're doing like tons of volume, tons of intervals, tons of this, tons of that, just really, really something super fatiguing. But it's kind of a little bit of everything. And then, you know, usually after that, you'll do like 3, 4, 5, whatever days of recovery. And hopefully you'll get a bump in fitness from that. And these are all like really useful tools in the toolbox. It's not bad. It's just like Izeron's block periodization is a lot more complex and there's a lot more to it than just like doing a week that just crushes you and then you recover a little more than normal, you know? So
this is actually interesting. And I don't want to like minimize, like, cause this is basically coming out of the Cold War, right? Like,
yeah.
Cause that is actually interesting. If you look back in the history of like how important sports were to just the kind of like civilizational contest that was going on back, like it sounds silly cause we were building nukes to like, and you know, end the world, you know, like, and like the space race and stuff, but like, who gets the gold medal in the 100-meter sprint was like genuinely important, even from just like a propaganda standpoint for both countries. Like, you know, like nothing makes, we were just talking about this. Nothing makes people more patriotic than like watching the rider under your flag win, or not the rider, I guess the athlete, because we're speaking more broadly here. But like, so this is actually interesting to me. And this stuff is probably, you know, when did this kind of come out of the kind of lab and into the kind of general consciousness of really cool, interesting
people
like you?
It's kind of just coming out now. Like, I don't think there's a whole lot of people that really understand some of these principles. And there's some really good kind of groundbreaking principles that I've learned from kind of hearing his stuff. Like originally I learned about some of his block periodization principles from a slideshow I was able to watch online. I've since gone back to try to find that slideshow and I can only find like snippets of it.
The KGB pulled it.
I think so. So that's kind of why I wanted to actually buy the book and just go through it and read it. And there's a lot of good stuff in there. I think in the future, it's probably a better reference than it is.
Are you going to like fall out of a window mysteriously in a week or something now that you found this book, or are you a marked man?
I don't think so, but, so let's talk about what block periodization is. But first, I think to do that, let's talk about traditional periodization first, which we mentioned. Traditional periodization, you know, the base, build, peak that we talk about all the time, that's nothing new. That's been around since the 50s. And the reason it stood the test of time is it's valid and good.
Yeah. Like, it has been around since the days when your pre-race meal was like a steak and a cigarette. Like, you know, like things have come a long way since then, right?
And the thing with it, for most of the athletes, I think traditional periodization works well and is probably preferable for like 95% of athletes.
So we're not talking smack about traditional periodization here, right?
Not at all. And in fact, the training I usually prescribe when I'm helping people is mostly traditional.
Yeah.
And I think it for what we're dealing with, I think it's generally preferable. I think it's especially traditional periodization is especially best for people that have been doing the sport for like less than 3 years. And I also think it's preferable for people that don't train year round.
Okay.
And I'll kind of explain why that is later. You know, like if you're like most of the Nike riders that pretty much take the winter and spring off, there's, you know, I don't think you'd find a lot of success in block periodization, even though I haven't really explained what it is yet. But yeah, so traditional periodization, we've talked about it a lot. I think a lot of people are fairly familiar with it. But usually your season's kind of broken up into a base period, which is usually kind of long, like 8 to 12 weeks or more even. But usually 8 to 12 weeks is kind of almost the minimum that you'd want to do in your base period. And then a build period that is 6 to 8 weeks, and that's where your work gets a little more race specific. That's when you start doing intervals and higher intensity stuff and you focus on that more. And then a peak where you've hopefully timed things out so that your fitness is at the best it's going to get, and you're hopefully timing that so it happens about the same time as your most important race. And then you take a long rest after that and you repeat it. And you can usually only repeat that, a lot of people say really once is ideal. I've always thought that like two is better, you know, to try and do it twice.
You're
a
not
season.
Doing five.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. So one or two is about all you can do. You can really only have one or two peaks a year under traditional periodization.
If you're actually hitting true peaks, right? Like, yeah, you could try to do this more, but then you're basically just never going to
do it. And actually peaking
is
pretty,
right,
elusive. It's something
we've done an episode on this.
Yeah, I'm not very good at helping people peak. I'm really good at getting them to peak the week before, but that's, you know.
Killer. Lots of random KOMs have been had, you know,
yeah,
in lieu of race results.
We're working on that. But another thing to point out too, just as a reminder with traditional periodization, the workouts are going to get more specific as you get closer to your target event. So like
we all hang out on the road bike all winter on Zwift, but then as you're getting closer to your cross country race or your cross race or your crit or whatever it is, you start to zero in on mimicking that a little more.
Yeah,
right?
Your intervals are going to be more specific to what you'll be doing during your target races and so forth, you know. So and I do think that like traditional periodization works really, really well. For example, someone that wants to peak for nationals and then wants to peak for Nike state champs, you know, that's pretty textbook of,
that's kind of what most people in our circle are looking to do, some version of that.
Yeah. But I do think with block periodization, there's some really interesting things that when you kind of start getting to a certain level could really be beneficial. And I actually apply a lot of the principles from block periodization into the, you know, the training I help people with. And so I think it's really, really worthwhile stuff. And, you know, and I think that a lot of people would get to a point, you know, if they want to become more professional at this, that this could be very beneficial for a pro.
Like, you'd better believe that, like, to win the Giro and the Tour in the same year, Tadej Pogacar has a really exact, like, super well thought out plan where they are hitting those peaks exactly where they need to be, right? Like, the, it's almost like the more pro you get, the more this comes into play.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, and I guarantee a lot of pro riders are doing something very similar to
probably
this.
Probably most at this
I
point.
I would think so. Yeah, so I'm gonna explain what it is. First, I'm gonna kind of give some background and some principles and so forth. But basically, block periodization is something that allows you to have multiple peak performances throughout the season. I wouldn't really call them peak performances, but I would maybe say more like multiple key performances throughout the season, like maybe four or five or six or whatever, you know. And the training is structured a little bit differently, that so it can accomplish that. But one of the things that makes this possible, and I'll talk more about this later, is you have to have a good base for this to work.
Like, as always, for most Nike riders, the answer is ride more.
I don't think they've been doing it long enough to really switch to this. But I do think that there's some that could, you know, that are getting to that point that this might be something to consider. But regardless, there's some really good principles in this that I think can be applied to traditional periodization. So, I'm going to read this. Block periodization is a sequencing specialized mesocycle blocks in which highly concentrated workloads are focused on a minimal number of motor and technical abilities.
Getting more specific, right? Wow, this book does sound rough.
Yeah. Yeah, a little hard to
that
get
That is
to.
The gist, though, right? That, like, we're saying specific set of, you're playing on two or three different strengths, not 30, right?
No, not two or three, like one.
Like one, okay.
Yeah. Yeah, you're basically, your training is, you have these certain periods of time where you are basically focusing on one thing at a time, and you're doing it in, like, a highly concentrated manner, and you're all, you know, and the theory is this, you kind of get to a point where you need that specific of stimulus for you to adapt. You know, whereas beginner riders, whatever you do, you're going
right.
to improve and get better and get faster and so forth. But more advanced riders are going to kind of get to a point where they really, really have to zero in on some of these abilities.
So when you say these abilities, are we talking about a specific amount of power? Are we talking about a lead out will be practicing this versus practicing a cross-country start? Are we talking about practicing what it feels like to do 325 watts instead of 340? Like, what are we talking
about? Yeah, that's a good question. So abilities is a term they use in the book. And for what we're doing, it kind of refers to basically whether that ability is kind of like a zone two or a sweet spot or a threshold or a VO2 max or a sprint, you know. It can mean other things, but for our intents and purposes, that's kind of what he means by abilities. You're basically focusing in on a specific energy system or an intensity range.
Okay. So this isn't maybe as specific as focusing on one cross-country course versus another, but like your cross-country rider, your crit racer, and your cross racer will be different here. Or is that going too broad? I'm just trying to zone in. We talk about different, like, energy systems is maybe the one to kind
energy,
of focus
energy
on?
Systems and intensities.
Okay.
You know. And yeah, definitely the modality of cycling that you do will determine what blocks you're doing to get ready for an event or so forth.
But we're not talking as specific as, oh, well, I'm practicing for the Solitude I Cup versus the Snowbird one.
No.
Okay.
No. Yeah.
Not that specific.
And so you're basically just dealing with really, really concentrated training that's just really, really focusing on one thing for a kind of a shorter period of time. And that is designed to give Because once you get to a certain point in cycling, it's harder to make gains and it's harder to notice improvements. And
your gain between year two and year three will be very different than your gain between year eight and year nine.
Yeah. And so this, you know, this is kind of a way that might break someone out of a slump or break someone out of a rut. You know, and like when we start out earlier, we mentioned kind of the hell week or the exhaust week or whatever training, yeah. You know, that can kind of do a similar thing. I think the difference with what a lot of those is that like you're doing like a lot of volume and a lot of work but you're not focused on one thing, you know, it's like you're just throwing in everything and then you're recovering from that. And so I think that's one of the key distinctions between kind of the modern day when people throw out the term block training versus how it was intended. The focus is critical. And one thing I do want to say about the kitchen sink training, that, you know, the hell week training or the exhaust week training, I do think that can be effective and it's worth trying. One thing that I do want to say there though is I think for most people consistency is going to be more important. And if you do a week that just destroys you and then cost you a whole week of recovery that you wouldn't have needed otherwise, I think for most people, you're probably not getting ahead.
No.
You know,
like do that when you have forced time off the bike.
Yeah. But if you have a recovery week coming up or you're going on a vacation, then I think it's good to, but yeah. But we're not really focusing on kitchen sink training this today.
It's not something you prescribe in situations that don't involve forced time off the bike, right?
Not unless someone's in like a plateau, it can be a tool to kind of get someone off a plateau.
Or if you're going to do, and I should say too, that like a lot of pros will kind of look at doing the tour as training, or if you're going to do the Breck Epic, that you could almost look at something like a forced hell week, but I don't think very many Nike riders are running into.
Well,
like
Jim
that.
Miller actually has his athletes all do a stage race
as training,
and that's interesting. That's kind of their.
Not necessarily relevant to us, but you know, sure, so. It's a thing.
But that's not really what we're traditional doing. Block yeah. training. I just wanted to kind of throw that out there. So, but yeah, but a key element of true block training is that laser focus on a certain ability during certain periods. So, let's talk about some principles of block periodization. The first one is concurrent training versus consecutive training. So concurrent training is when you're training multiple abilities at once, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And this training's just fine for amateurs, for most people. Most people, if you're riding your bike, you're probably getting faster.
Yes.
An example of this would be like on Monday, you have a rest day. On Tuesday, you do VO2 max training. On Wednesday, you do an endurance ride. On Thursday, you do threshold work. On Friday, you do strength training, and on Saturday, you do a ride that's like an endurance ride, but it's got some hard climbs and a few efforts, and, you know, so that's kind of like, sounds similar to like a lot of training that...
It's just if you just ride even socially, like, oh, well, I'm going to go out and ride with Jimmy this day, and we'll do that kind of ride, but then my road group's going to go out on Tuesday, I'll go do T&E on Tuesday. Like, if you kind of just doing whatever rides come up in front of you, you probably naturally end up doing this.
Yeah.
And you have multiple types of bikes. That's kind of where this is going to come into play, right?
Yeah. And that's concurrent training. And for like...
Again, for almost everyone.
Almost everyone, that is going to make you
100%.
Faster.
Yeah. Don't let a coach tell you that's wrong.
Yeah. But what we're trying to teach here with block periodization principles is consecutive training. And that's kind of what the pros that do this type of training are aiming for, because they need higher concentration of specific abilities to be able to signal adaptations. And, you know, an example of a consecutive week training is going to be like, you know, during a week, you're basically going to alternate between easy rides and VO2 max workouts all week.
And the focus there being the VO2 max workout, because you can't do that every day, right?
Yeah. And, you know, you have to allow yourself enough time between them that they're quality and so forth. It doesn't mean you're doing VO2 max workouts every single day, but it does mean that you're probably doing more than we normally prescribe. You know, you might be doing 3, maybe four.
Because in that block, you're focusing on that.
Yeah. Or, you know, or like there could be, you know, some of the consecutive training you could be doing is just zone two work.
Like when the pros go to Mallorca and they spend 2 weeks just doing just disgustingly long rides.
But
right?
That's all they're doing is just because they're just trying to send a really clear signal to their bodies. This is the adaptation we're after. This is what we're doing.
Yeah.
Or it could be threshold. You know, you're doing like three or four threshold workouts that week mixed with some easy rides in between. But you're not doing five different types of workouts and mixing it all in and making it this big, huge training salad and everything. And your workouts are very, very focused. And you know, you're just sending really clear signals that what adaptations you're after.
And again, the point here is to kind of break someone through at the point where that kind of training salad, that's great for most of us, just you're kind of sitting right at 89%, 89%, 89%. This is how you bump up to 91%, right? Like for that, and again, for the rider who is getting pretty close to their ceiling there and has kind of hit the plateau by signaling a specific adaptation, working on a specific skill. So out of curiosity, what percentage of people, of like Maybird riders, is this really relevant to, do you think? Like half of them or like 2% of them?
I think that, well, and maybe we'll get more into this later, but I think that, I don't know that it works super well during the NICA season because the races are too close together, and I'll kind of explain why. Tons of these principles, I think you can apply to traditional periodization. Because I haven't even really got to anything that's super unique to block yet. But I do think that, like, that this type of training, like World Tour, or not World, well, yeah, World Tour, but like mountain bikers racing the World Cup probably do something similar to this, you know. And when I kind of get into how you actually divide up the season, it is kind of cool how it works. It's really interesting. But right now, I think true block periodization probably wouldn't work super well until you're post-NICA.
Okay.
I think that, you know, most of our riders that are trying to peak for nationals and state champs, I think traditional works pretty darn well. But again, some of these principles could really help out too. But yeah, so that was kind of the first principle, and that's consecutive training rather than concurrent training. And that just basically kind of means you're just laser focused on one specific ability during a period of time. The next principle, and I've mentioned these before too, super important for the, and this is kind of what I think makes block periodization so beautiful, is residuals. And
I've never heard that term before. That is new to me.
Okay. So residuals are basically like certain types of abilities and fitness take certain amounts of time to develop and then certain amounts of time to get super compensation from and then certain amount of time before you lose it.
Super compensation being?
Well, when you work really, really hard, you get fatigued, you get, you know, you do some damage. It takes your body a while for the damage to repair itself. When it repairs itself better and stronger than before.
So the gain there is called your supercompensation?
Yeah.
Okay.
And you know, if it builds your body up better than it was before, that's considered supercompensation.
So we're looking at the wave here, you kind of go down.
Down.
The wave where we're back up above the baseline is your supercompensation.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's supercompensation. And residuals is how long those assets last without training them.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And for instance, like aerobic endurance, In theory, it'll last about 30 days without having to be maintained very much.
Okay.
And your maximum strength, like if you're doing like weightlifting and so forth, same. It could go about 30 days without really diminishing much, without maintaining it much.
What goes away? Do things go away quicker than that?
The more intense they get, the quicker they go away. Like VO2 max type efforts, their residual is about 15 days.
Okay.
And your like alactic anaerobic type efforts, like, you know, the short sprints, the 1 minute, 30 second, 10 second kind of stuff, that really only stays sharp for like 3 to 5 days.
So little Davey's riding his bike. He has a crash, bumps his head, has to take a month off the bike. that first ride back, he could match his hour power that he was doing when the crash happened. He's not going to be matching
his all-day
power. Yeah. He's going to match. He could match his all-day power, but his sprint's going to have gone away.
Exactly.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And so the beautiful thing about this whole system is being able to plan your training periods so that all these, you're still focusing on one asset at a time, but you devote enough time to each asset that by the time you're showing up to your key event, all the residuals are still intact.
Okay, that's interesting. And if you zoned out there, maybe I'll try to rephrase this in my own words and you tell me how close I get. Okay. You want to do this so that, and this is why you're getting more intense as you get closer to your thing, right? Because if you do, okay, you're like, I've got my race coming up. I'm going to do all of my sprint work 2 months before, and then I'll be doing my really big long rides right before the race. That's going to kneecap you because your sprint's going to go away in a week or two. So within a week or two, you have to have that sprint power intact if that's a critical part of your race, right? And then on top of that, there's the fact that like those really long days are going to completely nuke your legs and you're not going to feel good on the start line, which is why you can be working on that really long kind of, you know, diesel engine stuff way out from the race, far in advance of the race. That's still going to be intact when you hit race day. And the kind of dual benefit is that you kind of have to do your intense work pretty soon before the big day for it to be intact. And that type of work is generally less draining, so you're going to be fresher on the start line anyway. Is that somewhere in the neighborhood?
Yeah, kind of.
Right?
So basically, your aerobic endurance kind of stuff, it takes longer to develop, but you can keep it.
To lose it.
You can keep it for a while.
Okay.
So when you're dividing your training up, you focus on that first, and then you end that close enough to the event that if you stop focusing on that,
it'll still be there on that day. Cool. Okay.
And then you plan in kind of like your middle intensity kind of stuff or your VO2 max kind of stuff at a point where when you end that, it'll still be there and it'll be intact for race day. And then your high intensity stuff, you do that like closer so that when you end that and start resting up to compete, it'll still be there when you need it. Now, that's kind of like assuming that the event you're participating in needs intensity.
Sure.
You know, like if you're doing like, you know, if you're doing like an ultra endurance kind of thing.
Point-to-point doesn't call for a whole lot of 1,500-watt efforts.
Yeah.
It does call for some 500-watt efforts. You know, in mountain biking, technicality requires power.
Yeah. Right. I mean, and on those type of events, sometimes that's where you hear of like reverse periodization, where people still want to do that type of work just to round out their fitness, but they're intentionally going to lose it by the time they get to the race just because they don't need it. And,
right.
You know, because
you're not going to spend your workouts on
that. Yeah, because always the number one rule with whatever periodization is that you're getting more specific to the event as you get closer to the event.
Sure.
So that's the theory of residuals. Super cool. Super cool to keep in mind. Now, another principle in Iseron's block periodization is compatibility. I'm not going to get too far into this, but sometimes like combining certain types of training modalities within a certain workout or a certain period of time can have kind of like negative interactions.
Really?
Yeah. And like, for instance, a good classic one I can think of is like, if you're trying to combine sweet spot work with VO2 max work.
Oh, okay. That makes sense.
They just don't.
They're maybe even more than canceling each other out. Like you can't do those. And if you think you're doing them, you're not.
You're not.
Right?
Yeah.
Like definitionally.
One is affecting the quality of the other or something.
Definitionally, those two cannot really work together. Okay. Yeah. That makes sense.
And I think understanding the compatibility of different workouts can be a little bit confusing. Like there's some type of workouts that do better with strength training and not, depending on your goals, you know. But I would say that the thing that's easy here to remember is that most training is compatible with zone 2 rides and recovery rides.
Sure.
And this came out before polarization was super popular.
Okay.
But I think that's kind of the thing to remember there is that, you know, when you're doing quality work, it's quality work only if you're doing other training that's compatible with it. And usually that comes in the form of discipline when you're doing zone two.
Yep. Which we've talked about at length. We don't need to.
Yeah, we've mentioned that before.
You should understand. Yes. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. And along with this, this is kind of an example why maybe avoiding kitchen sink training could be beneficial for those that are kind of getting up there and towards their potential and, you know, and finding it harder to achieve gains. So, one thing that this book, I think, really emphasized quite strongly, and this is the next principle, is just the importance of your key workouts. And like your key workouts really need to be identified and prioritized. And you really need to, like, if you've got a key workout, you need to make sure that A, you're like coming into it like in the right frame of mind, you know, that you've kind of like, I always like to say, you know, you flip a switch, like, yeah, today's going to be hard. I'm going for it. You flip the switch that you're in like hard workout mode, you know. B, that you're like, you kind of have like ideal conditions that, you know, you're rested, you've had sufficient rest, your other workouts have been easy enough that you're going to be able to accomplish the key workouts in a quality way, that you're well fueled, that you're not at too high of an elevation, that it's not too hot, that you're doing it somewhere cool, and you know, and maybe even that, you know, depending on the period of time that you're doing it, that you could be mimicking circumstances you'll face in a race situation or so forth, you know. So, but this book really, really emphasized how important your key workouts are and how treating them as such is going to make a difference in your training. You know, you're not like if you have a key workout that you're doing, if you just kind of go through the motions, you're not really getting the full benefits from it. If it's something that you really, really kind of base your week around and really, really make those key workouts count.
Right. So, because we're talking about like mushy training, like when we're talking about mushy training, this is kind of what a lot of that comes down to. Like, that's right, I got to do these today. I feel like crap, but we'll just do it. It's snowing outside and my bike doesn't work. And, you know, like kind of the psychological fact that like, this is hard, you know, it's mentally tough. Same goes for racing, I think, just kind of, you know, like the intentionality of like, okay, Wednesdays, I don't want to say you should be like nervous going into it, but maybe a little bit.
I think you should be a little bit.
Like you should be like, this is going to suck. But those are this, again, this is why this sport is hard, right? Because those are the days that do kind of make a lot of the difference here, right?
Yeah. And so all these, like, these are just kind of background principles that I think are important to understand in implementing block periodization. But I think all of these things can be applied to our training now and would be beneficial.
Yeah.
You know, and I do try to apply a lot of these principles, and I have for a while, and I think that they're important. But let's actually talk now about how to plan out how block periodization actually kind of makes your calendar look different than traditional periodization, because there are some kind of cool things here that I think is really interesting. So rather than just having kind of like traditional periodization where you got like a base, a build, and a peak, and then a rest, and that might be your entire season.
Yeah.
You know, how block periodization works is you have three, and they call them mesocycles. And you have these three mesocycles, and each of those mesocycles makes up a training season, a training stage, which leads up to like an event. Okay, so you have these three periods that leads up to an event, and that can be repeated like four, five, six times. It can be repeated multiple times during the season. And it's almost kind of like this could almost be a take home, but it's basically like you're doing like a mini base build and peak for each race that you do. You know, rather than doing it for an entire season, each event you have coming up, you'll do like a mini base, a mini build, and then a mini peak for that. And that's kind of how it's broken up. And each of these little periods, like, so these periods of the base, build, and peak, they actually have different terms. And these are each called mesocycles. And the first mesocycle, in the terminology they use, is the first one's accumulation, which is kind of, we're just going to say it's a synonym for base. But the accumulation mesocycle it can be 2 to 4 weeks. And this is where you have really high volume, really reduced intensity, and very little specificity. It doesn't really need to be super specific. So, like I say, the accumulation mesocycle is very similar to just like a mini base period. And again, that can last, depending on the event, that can last 2 to 4 weeks. Like on a longer, like if you're preparing for like point to point or like a big long race, that accumulation period would last longer. Something like a cross race, it could be on the shorter end of things. So that's the accumulation mesocycle. The next mesocycle is called the transmutation mesocycle. This is about 2 to 4 weeks. And this is very similar to what we would think of as kind of like a build period. And this is the period where it's the most sport specific, it's the most stressful, it's the most fatiguing. This is going to be like the hardest part of each training stage is the transmutation cycle. Again, it's about 2 to 4 weeks, and it's very race specific. It's very intensive. And like we said before, it's going to be, like when we talked about consecutive training, it's going to be very, very specific, and you're going to be very laser focused on one ability. You know, in the accumulation phase, you really kind of worked on more your like your basic aerobic abilities. That's going to maintain intact while you're focusing on these more intense, more specific abilities during the transmutation phase. But
like you move from base into some intervals that address that particular thing.
Yeah.
Okay.
And again, yeah, this is the most fatiguing. So the next mesocycle is called the realization mesocycle, and this is a week or two maybe. And it says here, I'm just going to read out of the book, the first objective is to provide and facilitate restoration and ultimately to attain supercompensation state at the time of competition. So basically the restoration phase of the training stage is so you rest up a little bit so you can realize, so your body has time to adapt and supercompensate from the two previous harder training blocks you've just completed.
And like that's common sense that like you're not going to finish your VO2 block and then the next day is your race.
Yeah.
Right. There has to be some time, I mean, to realize it, and then also just to not be like, if you've done one of these, you'll know that at the end of it, you're not going to feel great. You're going to feel like death, you know?
And the, and this is really accomplished by reducing the workload. This is where volume goes down, intensity maintains fairly high, but the volume goes down. But they really, during this point, you really focus on some of your technical, tactile type abilities, like your skills. That's where this really needs to be honed in during this time. You know, so it's very similar to what we consider tapering.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah. And so basically what we have here, it's kind of like for each target event, you've got your own little mini base build and peak phase that you do. And, you know, and you know, you kind of build up your base during the first few weeks. That maintains intact while you're really focusing for a week or two on the high intensity intervals. And then you have a week or two where you reduce the volume and, you know, you kind of freshen up and you let some of those like abilities, like the adaptations, kind of develop over that rest time. And then you go perform. And it's designed so that can be repeated multiple times throughout the season.
And what is multiple again, roughly?
4, 5, 6, you know.
Right. So this isn't like, oh, my 2A things are, I don't know, like nationals and state champs, or my 2A things are this crit in April and then cross state champs. Like this is for, so this, again, not all the races, because a lot of kids listening to this do more than 6 races a year. Right. But is this why it's kind of tricky for NICA, where you have 5 races that are a month apart?
Well, they're like 2 weeks apart. So,
oh, yeah, that's true. That's how it works now, huh?
Yeah. And typically these training stages, they are, you know, they're as short as 4 weeks and as long as 10.
Okay.
And yeah, you know, so
that's why it's kind of tricky to do this through NICA. This makes sense. So maybe for our parents listening to this who are big racers, this is more relevant to you, or it's more relevant to me. If Nike is the goal, this is not, that doesn't really work with, that's sort of incompatible, right?
Yeah. And then another reason it's not super compatible too is because, like, this is assuming you've already developed a really solid base throughout the winter and, you know, throughout the different seasons you've been riding, you've already got a pretty solid base in that you could, you know, that you could only focus on base for like 2 to 3 weeks. And, you know, if you're just new to training and only did 2 to 3 weeks of base training, that's something like,
exactly for you,
that's not going to do anything.
Just ride more.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But if you're kind of at a maintenance level with your base training, that would be sufficient to maintain it.
Like maybe the only reason you'd want to do this is if with NICA, you're like, I care about races 1 and 4 or for reason.
No, exactly.
Cause I do think there's some value, and there are some pros who will just be like, yep, I'm not going to be at my best on this day. And that's fine. I have to do the race. Cause it's, I have to. Right. Mm-hmm. Or like with guys going into the tour, I'm sure that there are guys where they're like, you know what? I'm a lead out and there's like 4 sprint stages in the first week. And then the rest of it's just getting through and hopefully being there the last day versus like a GC guy who's like, I am here to dominate in the high mountains of week 3. So I don't really care how well I'm doing on, you know, it's like, unless there's one of those. But I think for most kids, I think you should try to do your best at every race. There's still so many variables there. And especially where like your placing is determined by how you do, you kind of can't, like, am I wrong there with the rules? Like it would be bad for you to suddenly finish 30th in one of the races if your goal is to get first in others. Like that doesn't help with your call up.
Yeah.
So yeah, I don't know. This is a principle for you to understand and apply for however's relevant to you, right?
But again, there's so many things in here that we could apply to our normal training. You know, I mean, just the fact that, like, you do have a race coming up, it's probably a good idea to be feeling good and fresh for it.
Yes.
You know, if you've done a lot of intensity and a lot of hard work, maybe dial it in and focus on certain things rather than doing this and that and this and that and this interval that day and another totally different interval that day that you never do again the rest of the season, you know.
Yeah.
You know, maybe really kind of laser focus your intervals a little bit more.
Oh, and also to throw out, like, those jibe Friday night races, those are intervals in some ways, I think. Or like, don't pick something like that. Like, you can train through that, right? Like, this is just a reminder that, like, don't apply this to every single race that you touch. I think it's good for kids to be doing, for most kids, I think it's good for them to be doing a lot of racing. Like, pick races that are more relevant to you than others, right? So like midweeks or jibe Friday nights or whatever, I don't know, you know, like train through those or whatever. Don't be necessarily doing like a week off for one of those, right? Unless that's your thing for some reason, right?
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, we probably better get wrapping this up here soon. Hopefully this has been interesting. I think it's, you know, you do hear the term training block or block this, block that thrown around.
I've done
a lot.
Yeah.
And it kind of can mean different things.
Right.
I do think some of these principles are pretty cool and awesome. You know, just as like a review that, like, you know, block periodization is basically you're just kind of having a mini base, mini build, and mini peak kind of before each event that you do. And is your, like, during the accumulation phase, your volume's high, intensity low, and your specificity's low. During the transmutation period, your volume's lower, but your intensity's higher, and your specificity's also higher. And then during the realization, as you get closer to the event, your volume's lower, but your intensity and specificity remain high. And then that's also where you kind of throw in more of the technical skills that are going to really, really benefit you during that. And, you know, I do think that, like, that this could work, you know, if you're like, if you did like a, you know, like you did a kind of traditional periodization for like an event that kind of happened in the middle of your season and then had one coming up later that was close to it, I could kind of see throwing in like some block periodization to get ready for that, you know, where you're kind of like touching up some of these abilities you've previously developed and just making sure everything's kind of fresh and ready to go on race day. But yeah, it's interesting stuff. I think there's good principles, but I think really for me, for you, for pretty much most people listening, that really just consistency is key. Making your hard workouts count, your key workouts count, making sure you're getting enough rest, taking care of yourself. And, you know, I think those are the things that are going to make most of us faster, you know. But if you do, you know, in your cycling career, kind of get to a place where you might want to kind of go up to the next level and you feel like you're kind of getting stale and your consistency doesn't seem to be improving you as much as you'd want it to, that maybe this is something you could consider. I would say that this would be fairly difficult to plan out on your own.
This is the value of a coach, right? Like that they understand this and can apply this to your individually complex situation to make it relevant for you, right? Because even, like, I don't know that I could effectively apply this to my own calendar, per se, you know?
No, and to be honest, most of the training I do is very traditional. It might be fun to experiment with this on somebody, you know, but
like, you know, like with a lot of things, it's a good principle for you to understand so that you can apply it to your situation, you know, as much as possible.
And like I say, I love some of the principles that Izzeron teaches and so that can be applied to whatever we do, you know, regardless of how we chunk up our seasons. So should we do a special word today?
Special word. I don't know. Let's think. What if we could do taco, because Cole tacoed his rotor.
Okay.
Taco.
Sounds good.
Soviet taco. All right, folks. Well, everybody ride safe this week. Slightly lower temps, it looks like. That should be nice.
Oh,
I'm looking forward to that. I think when I checked a few days ago, it could have changed. But ride safe. We'll look forward to talking to you guys next week. And way to be troopers, making it through kind of a long one here. So we will talk to everybody soon.
Okay.